Paul Essen, and I'm joined by Chief Political Correspondent and Debate Expert Andrew Riley. And Andrew, we had a pretty exciting, exciting is not even the word either. We had a debate. Yeah, we had a debate.
But did we actually have a debate? Was there debate going on?
There was yelling.
I'm not entirely sure.
Loud noises.
It was called debate. Loud noises. That's the meme that has been going around today, and I think it's incredibly accurate. If you are not a fan of these kinds of things and you avoided watching it because you knew it was going to be painful, congratulations. You've made the right choice.
Yeah, I mean, I know this is going to sound like totally underselling it, but Donald Trump's debate style is not my cup of tea. and I know that's going to be like understatement of the year, but seriously, like I think I have a pet peeve against people talking over each other. It's one of those things where even when it's done unintentionally, like during video meetings, like the beginning of this podcast, when we were kind of unintentionally talking over each other, I was cringing a little bit inside because there's just something about me that really hates that. And Donald Trump seems to thrive on that. That seems to be all he ever wants to do, is just try and talk over people and enforce his will on people. And God, that was so painful to watch. I know everyone was saying it was painful to watch, but I had to fight the impulse to just turn off the TV a number of times.
These debates tend not to be things that people enjoy watching. It's one of the reasons why we spent so much time going through the Democratic debates and watching them. We were watching them for our own interest, but also we were watching them so we could talk about them so other people who didn't watch them because they're not enjoyable experiences could get something out of them. This presidential debate tends to have a much higher number of participants watching. Like in 2016, the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump had 84 million people watching. That's a lot of people. I mean, it's still a very small percentage of the United States population overall, maybe a quarter. But of the voting population and of the ones who actually voted, a fairly substantial number of them probably watched that debate. I haven't seen the ratings for this one yet, but I imagine that those ratings started bad and got worse as the debate went on. Which is a bit of a shame.
Is it really?
It got better. I mean, in a very narrow sense, it was a better experience at the end of the debate than it was at the beginning.
Maybe. I don't even know if I agree with that. But
it's really tenuous, I understand, but
I have a question for you. What percentage of the viewers of these debates do you think are legitimately undecided and watching it to try and become informed and learn about the candidates to make a better decision versus people who are just like, I want to see to make sure that my guy wins or does well?
I'm going to try and answer that question, and then I'm going to spin it towards the question that I was been thinking about a lot over the past 24 hours since that debate. So how many people watched the debate with the intent of getting information about which candidate they're going to choose? They could vote for Trump, they could vote for Biden, they just don't know, and how the debate goes will sway them. It's a minority. I don't think it's a very large percentage of people overall. Maybe 5%.
That low.
I think it might actually be lower than that. I'm trying to be generous. The thing that I was thinking about is the people who were watching this says I do think that most of them were coming in with a preference. You know, the Trump fans came in expecting Trump and were hoping that he would perform well. The Biden fans, or at least the people who really hate Trump, were coming in saying, please, Joe, please just don't screw this up and show me something that makes me feel okay about the fact that I have to vote for you. Or, yay, Joe, I liked you and you gave a good performance. Thank you. You didn't fall asleep on the stage. They're looking for things they can hang their hat on and feel better about the fact that they have committed themselves to vote for the candidate that they've already chosen to vote for. In that sense, I think Biden did pretty well in that he didn't make the big, big, big mistakes that he's been known to make in debates. You know, he had plenty of ugly moments, but he had some fiery moments. He showed some passion. We'll talk about some of that probably later on. But he also was not making those mistakes. Like I said, he stayed on target and had lucid points, which is unexpected for Joe.
Yeah, I came into this debate hoping that something entertaining would happen. And I say that in the sense that there'd be some sort of epic gaffe by Biden, you know, go to Joe 3030, or there would be a situation where they would both challenge each other to see who could do the most push-ups, or Biden would lose his temper and, you know, call Trump fatso, or any of those things that we've seen on the campaign trail from Biden. And I was greatly disappointed, because in every way that I was hoping for a disaster that would have been entertaining, those things didn't happen. Instead, I got a whole bunch of disasters that were not entertaining in the least.
The things that did happen were definitely not entertaining. Joe did call Trump some names. He said some very mean things about him. Come on, you're the worst president ever. Guy has no idea what he's talking about. Just shut up, man. You know,
it's incredible that the candidate who said, "Yeah, just shut up, man. You're a clown. You're the worst president ever." Yeah, all these things is considered to have been by far the one with the most decorum during the debate. That's pretty incredible. Like, I was thinking about this. I agree with you. I think that simply by virtue of not completely melting down, like, I thought both candidates went in. I had a low bar in terms of my expectations for them. I expected a disaster, and I got a disaster. Trump blew past that and was 10 times worse than what I thought he might be. Biden slipped under that bar. He didn't have the epic gaffe, like you said. He didn't lose his temper, even, which must have taken some superhuman. I mean, he did lose his temper a little bit, but not nearly as much as I thought that he might.
Given his tendencies towards, you know, blowing up at reporters, the fact that he contained himself against Trump shows that he was well coached, expected the barb to come in.
And I don't know if you've noticed this, but I was watching, and I don't think it was just a trick at the camera. Trump spent most of the time, especially the time that he wasn't sparring with the moderator, pretty much just staring at Biden. And Biden very clearly made it a point to basically never look at Trump. He was always looking either at the moderator or at the camera or somewhere else. But it looked like he almost was making a conscious effort to not even acknowledge Trump was there. And I think that was probably very intentional.
I think it was definitely intentional, because it gives Biden an ability to control things that he wouldn't have had if he was looking at Trump. If when we think back again to the 2016 debates, one of the things that was so much of a meme after the debate between Trump and Clinton was Trump dominating the debate with his physical presence. He was a big man. He owned the stage. He stalked her, in a sense, on that stage and hounded her around and controlled the physical space. And he was trying to do the same thing with Joe, because he was staring down. He made the eye contact. He was the alpha. And Biden wasn't playing along. He didn't make the eye contact. And that allowed him then to be apart from that and not part of Trump's game.
Do you think that rattled Trump at all?
I don't think it rattled Trump at all. I think Trump thought that meant he was winning.
It made him seem like Joe was weak.
I'm the alpha. You aren't even paying me you're not giving me any attention at all, which is offensive. But it also proves exactly what my point was, is that you're not worthy of my time. You're already a defeated dog.
So you think that – so let me ask you this. Who do you think won the debate? Because you mentioned that Joe came in, managed to largely avoid the epic meltdown. And I don't think you outright said you thought he won the debate, but let me just have you clarify.
It's really, really hard to say that anybody won this debate. Mm-hmm. You had a spectacular tweet last night that I happened to see earlier today, which is that basically Joe Jorgensen won the debate. You know, congratulations, Joe Jorgensen, for having an hour and a half primetime ad last night. I don't know how you had the budget for it, but you know, anybody who watched this did not think that Joe Biden won. He just didn't lose. And Trump also didn't win, and also didn't lose nearly as much as I think a lot of people are claiming he's lost. So I'm going to give it 80% to Biden and 20% to Trump, where I don't think that either won or lost. I think Joe came closer to winning it. But I will say that Trump came in with a couple of things that he wanted to do, and he executed on those far better than a lot of people were giving him credit for. Yes, it was an uncouth and ugly display of nastiness and non-coherent thinking, but he talked about some of the things he wanted to talk about, the things that he felt could motivate his base or motivate some people who care about specific things who don't normally vote to consider voting for him. So if they're watching it, or if they see some of those highlights, they might say, yeah, okay. And yeah, it is completely pointless. For example, Trump says, I brought back football. Really? That's your political line? But most people don't care enough about politics. And you can look at the football season that we're having this year, and except for the fact that now we have just had the news today that the Tennessee Titans have had an outbreak of coronavirus, and maybe football is not back after all, the quality of the game on the field has been, I feel, higher this year than it has for the past couple. And Trump's going to find some way to claim credit for this. And, you know, it's still the most popular sport in this country. And if people say, yeah, Trump stood up to the NFL owners and got their back and made them not take care of Colin Kaepernick and his stupid protest, and look, he's standing up to Black Lives Matter, etc. And you can ascribe racist motives to a lot of that. Fine. But if what you care about for racist motives or otherwise is this return to what things were, this Make America Great Again thing, then he is still playing to that base in a way that a lot of people who watched that debate from a neutral perspective or a pro-Biden perspective don't get to see.
Were you surprised that they had an audience there? Because that was the first thing that stuck out to me when they showed Chris Wallace, and immediately I could tell in the background that there's an audience, and I'm like, really? You have the perfect opening in this era. Also, first of all, I think it's questionable to ever have an audience at a debate. I think there's no clear benefit. It has certainly has the potential to kind of sway the outcome of the debate. You know, people watching from home, they hear the crowd booing something. It biases you. Or you, likewise, it can bias the candidates. If you get a good applause line or you get silence when you're hoping a joke lands, I see no clear benefit to having an audience, and particularly now with social distancing, COVID, all these other things, like, this is the perfect opportunity to not have the audience and to just fix that problem. I was surprised that the audience was there.
I won't say I was surprised because I had read that they were going to have an audience, but I was surprised when I heard they were going to have an audience. Okay, so because many of the reasons you're talking about, that's not something that seems like it's a wise thing to do right now. But, I mean, movie theaters are open in most of the country, and people are going about their business. So the fact that this is something that would go on, it's an entertaining thing, or could have been an entertaining thing, even if it turned out not to be in this case. So people want to see it. And to your point of it can influence the debate, that's actually, I think, why they do it. I mean, why do you go see a movie in the movie theater rather than sit at home and watch the movie at your home theater on your nice big TV and your comfy couch with your cheaper snacks and your family around you when you can talk and use the restrooms? Why do you go out of the way to watch a movie in a public place with other people, except the fact that watching it in that environment changes how you feel about the experience and makes it somehow better? By having participants other than the debaters, you know, someone to laugh at a laugh line or applaud an applause line or boo when they say something really stupid, makes it more real and more engaging for a community.
How did you think that Chris Wallace did as a moderator? He had his hands full, and I haven't heard – there's been some criticism lobbed his way in terms of him losing control, but frankly – I can't fault him for that. Like, he did his best within the things that he was able to control to keep that under control.
So the two points I want to make with regards to the moderation here are, one, the candidates set the rules for the debate, and he was trying to enforce the rules. So you can argue the rules are stupid, and they were, but the candidates were the ones who negotiated them and agreed to them, or the candidates' parties. And they wanted to negotiate the result that would be best for them, not the one that would produce the best debate or the best discussion about policy, because they're not interested in having a discussion about policy. They're interested in winning the election. So they want to have a performative experience where they get to put their best foot forward. And then once you have those sets of rules, the moderator has to try to work policy into it in a way that is meaningful. I felt that his question selection was pertinent, but not the best, and that he had probably the best techniques that you could possibly use to try and maintain control in that environment, but that obviously it was essentially a superhuman task. So I can't say I fault him, but I'm not going to give him a ton of praise either. I think he was exactly what that moment required and nothing more.
Do you think that they absolutely need to have a mute button for the next debate where you can actually shut off a candidate's microphone? I understand it's still somewhat problematic because obviously the other candidate, if you're close enough, you can still hear the other person bellowing at you. But at the very least, it would make it so that, hey, you can't, I don't care how much you want to try and bring up the whatever Russian money to Hunter Biden or whatever Trump was trying to sneak in there. You're not going to be able to get that on national TV.
Well, the candidates always pivot the question to what they want to talk about anyway, regardless of the debate format. So, you know, Hunter Biden and the Russian money thing is never going to go away. I'd like to see the moderators have the level of control where they could mute a candidate who is not being asked a question so that there is less crosstalk. That's beneficial for everyone. It makes the experience cleaner and clearer. You know, one of the things that's very important about this, I think, for a broad understanding is that you have two men who are old and talking in jumbled sentences, talking quickly to an audience of potential voters, many of whom don't understand English as well as you and I do, many of whom have English as a second language, maybe who don't have English as a language at all. And some of these translations are going to be very difficult. You know, we live in a diverse country. And if you have people talking over each other, that's really, really hard to understand in the best of circumstances. And so if you want to have a clean, clear debate about issues and points rather than this mishmash, then yeah, you want to have that mute button as an option. It's not going to happen because the candidates will never agree to it. They want to be able to talk whenever they want to talk and just fight it out verbally on the stage because that's what is best for them. You know, exert dominance or at least be able to respond instantaneously once they feel the other candidate is getting out of line verbally at all.
I was kind of laughing while you were saying that because sometimes I feel like Trump's first language isn't English. And I've certainly read I've read more than one article about how it's can be so incredibly difficult for people who are trying to transcribe what the president said. And the
stream he doesn't speak in sentences.
Yeah, he basically it's a stream of conscious way of speaking, and it's super unclear even after you listen to it a number of times, like where a thought ends and a new thought begins, and which punctuation to use. Is this like is this a period here? Was that the end of a thought, or is it like a?
Yeah, I pity anyone trying to diagram those sentences. But that's actually one of his strengths as a public speaker, is that despite the fact that it's incomprehensible, he makes himself known to people who aren't expecting concrete sentences. You know, when he expresses himself, a lot of the country hears him and hears either what they want to hear or hears a version of what he's saying that allows them to understand that he means something in a specific way that people looking for those full sentences maybe don't hear anymore. That's one of the things that is significant about Trump's success is that he appealed very, very strongly to non-college educated whites, right? Now, he pulled that base away from the Democrats, the union blue-collar worker. He said, "Yep, you're mine now. I'm going to be your guy. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to take care of you." And in part, that's because he's able to speak an informal language that they understand. He's speaking off the cuff and he's speaking in non-sentences. But he says phrases and emotions, really. He speaks in emotions that they can then pick up on and understand what he means in a way that when we're looking at the actual sentences, we're like, why do you think that? What makes you think that he means any of that? He clearly doesn't mean that. But they get it, right?
So this is too good of a transition to pass up. So I want to skip ahead to something that happened relatively late, I think, in the debate. And then that's the part where – and it's probably the – I think it's the part that's made the most news other than just the general tone of the debate has been when Chris Wallace asked Donald Trump, will you explicitly denounce the support of white supremacists and tell them to stand down or not yep. stand down, tell them to accept the results of the elections. I can't remember the exact phrasing of the question.
And I don't think the election even came in at that point because that was a different discussion. But yeah, he's like, you know, will you denounce the white nationalist neo-Nazi groups that are perpetuating violence on this country? Right. And Trump's like, well, I see the violence and it's mostly coming from the left. And who exactly do you want me to denounce? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's saying it. That's what he is saying, but he's saying it in such a way that it is very, very difficult to understand what he's actually saying. And in part because it's this ongoing and evolving conversation between him and Matthews where it's like, okay, what do you want me to denounce? And I'm not going to actually let you answer that question. I'm going to start denouncing somebody first, but you know, continue on with that.
Right, yeah. And I hesitate I hesitate to go too far on this because I don't want to sound at all like I'm defending what Trump said there, because there was a lot of badness in what he said in there. But I actually think there's a pretty decent chance that he thinks that he very clearly denounced white supremacists in his statement. Because of by virtue of the way that he speaks, and he's done this in the past too, with the good people on both sides comment, where he's come out and said, like, no, I very clearly denounced the white supremacist or whatever. And if you look through what was said, and you again you cut out like the second half of it where he's like, yeah, it's all Antifa and stand by and or step back and stand by or whatever it was. At first, he's like, yeah, sure, I'll denounce them. What do you want me to call them? I'll denounce them right now. And then he starts the sentence, and then immediately he shifts off into, like, it's all Antifa's fault, and they're all going to maybe it's not the election. I thought it was tied up with how they're going to steal the election or anything. But anyway.
Go ahead.
It just struck me as a perfect example of what you're talking about, how it seems clear to anybody who is looking for complete sentences that he was trying to wiggle out of denouncing white supremacists and sending out dog whistles and was maybe even trying to rile them up. And I'm not saying that's a wrong interpretation at all. I think that's a very valid interpretation. And I do think there's a lot of trouble with what Trump said. But I think that in Trump's mind, he thinks that he hit it out of the park and absolutely denounced white supremacists there. And I think that's why I would push back slightly on your comment about his strengths as a public speaker, because yes, I do see how that does have some benefits to it, but man, does it have a lot of downsides too, where you leave yourself open to a lot of misinterpretation.
Yeah, it's a polarized thing where everyone who was already very anti-Trump got to see exactly what they were afraid of. And everyone who is already pro-Trump says, look, he denounced the white supremacists, if they are against white supremacists. And his white supremacist fan base are like, yay, he told us to stand by.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Ready to go.
Everyone heard exactly what they wanted to hear. Yeah, the white supremacists are like, yes, that's the dog whistle we were looking for. The people who are like, yes, that's the media always misinterpreting Trump and taking his words out of context. And then everyone else is like, just like there you go. He absolutely, he flat out called for his white supremacist supporters to
be on standby.
Stand by for future orders. Yeah, like that. Those are all like all wrapped up into that jumbled.
Yeah.
Paragraph of that, word salad.
You know, that 2 minutes of the debate has been picked out as the most important 2 minutes of the debate. And I agree. I think that was the defining moment of this debate. And that's unfortunate, because that's not a great moment to have to focus on. But it is emblematic of the moment that the country finds itself in right now, where it is extremely divided, hyperpartisan, and along some very odd lines. You know, it's not red-blue Republican-Democrat lines so much anymore, because you do have this stratification of violence against police cracking down on violence with more violence. You have the implicit racism aspects of police violence. You have various militia groups that have become radicalized and much more mobile over the past 4 years. You know, is that Trump's fault? A little bit. Is it Facebook's fault? Definitely. It's all coming together into this melange of an experience that Trump is speaking to, and that's important, but it doesn't mean it's good.
It all comes back to Facebook with you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm gonna hammer on Facebook a lot. Probably not tonight, but I'm gonna continue to hammer on Facebook.
Fair enough. I think so. I agree. That was a big moment of the debate, and rightfully so. I think it's a bit of a shame, though, because that also happened around the same time as, I think it was the same pair of questions, where Chris Wallace asked Joe Biden about packing the court. And maybe I'm off about my timeline, but as I remember it, he asked Biden, basically, are you going to pack the court? And if I recall, Biden said, I'm not going to answer that question right now. And
he dodged it very deftly, but he dodged it also not deftly, because he didn't even come close to answering the question. And Wallace let him off with it. He did not press him on the issue.
And I'll give Wallace – I'll cut Wallace some slack here. I'm pretty sure Trump immediately started like jumping
oh, yes,
in
no.
and like basically made it impossible to ask any follow-up questions. So it's unfortunate that those follow-up questions weren't asked, but I don't necessarily blame Wallace for it. But
that's an absolutely fair point. I don't necessarily blame Wallace either, but it is a thing that didn't happen that probably should have happened.
And I would even argue, I don't think he definitely avoided either, because he, I mean...
He avoided, let's put it that way then.
He basically, I mean, yeah.
He said that's for the people to decide. So basically, what he said was, as my interpretation of it was, look, if they haven't nominated someone and confirmed them by the time of the election, then the people get to choose, and they choose between me and Trump, and then we nominate the next person when we come back. And therefore, the lame duck session should not confirm. That was how I would interpret the first part. And second part of that, the people get to decide, is if they have already confirmed, then the people get to decide, and they say, we're okay with that, or we're not okay with that. And if they're not okay with that, they vote for me. And then I come in and I correct that situation by the mechanism that I feel is best suited for the Republic.
Yeah, I guess I come into this with my own bias, where I think that court packing would be an extremely stupid idea. And so to me, it seems obvious that it's like, you know, if someone asks if you're a god, you say yes. If someone asks you if you're going to pack the court, you say no. And like, you just don't do it. Like, why would you leave yourself open to that idea? And the fact that he pretty clearly didn't even try and hide it's not even like Elizabeth Warren when she was trying to weasel out of like the raising taxes on the middle class or whatever it was that she was trying to weasel out of. He pretty much flatly said, like, I'm not going to answer the question. And that was a major warning light to me, because I thought he did a great job of dodging all the other times that Trump tried to tar him with the far left in terms of the Green New Deal and getting rid of private insurance. He did a pretty good job of basically saying, like, nope, he's lying. That's not my plan at all. But in this one, I think that one landed for me. It was that was the one instance where I felt like Joe, he wasn't able to play the moderate card there. That was a tip of the hat to the far left, which is, you know, somewhat understandably upset over the Supreme
Court. I mean, obviously, the far left is extremely upset about the situation. But I would say the left in general is upset about this. And I know a fair number of people who are fairly conservative and are upset about this, because, you know, the whole point of the Supreme Court is you respect precedent. And we set a precedent, and maybe it was the wrong precedent. I certainly agree it was the wrong precedent, but a precedent was set. And now, you know, 4 years later, this precedent is not being followed because it's politically expedient. And you said that, you know, from your perspective, packing the court is a terrible idea. In practice, I agree. In principle, I agree. But in reality, in the situation that we have right now, is it any more of a nuclear option than destroying the filibuster for the federal judges? Or is it any more of a nuclear option than anything that has gone on with the Supreme Court over the past 8 years? And Joe Biden is very interestingly at the very center of this complete devolution of civil politics around the Supreme Court. Because it was Joe Biden in his 1988 run for president who decided that one of the best ways he could get some extra publicity and name recognition for himself as a candidate was to absolutely scuttle Robert Bork. He came in, and now we have Bork as a verb because of what he did to that justice who was qualified. Now, he was political. He had opinions that were unpopular with half of the people in that room. But he came in, and they made it personal. They attacked his character in ways that were unfair and false, and politicize the process. And that was the push that got us to where he is now, talking about packing the court when he gets elected president in 2020. It's Joe Biden, 100%.
Well, I mean, when you're in politics for, what, 47 years, is that what the running tally is? I mean, you have your hand in a lot of stuff, I would imagine.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff he's had his hand in has been disastrous.
Yeah.
Then we're in the situation where he's the guy who is the more sane, better choice. You know, in any other election, Joe Biden would be one of the worst candidates for president ever. And yet, because he's going against Trump, it's very much like Trump running against Clinton 4 years ago. Well, nobody wants Trump, but nobody wants Clinton.
And it's not even a hypothetical. He's run for president how many times in the past and always came in embarrassingly, like, last, like whether it was a plagiarism scandal or a gaffe in terms of calling Obama clean and articulate or whatever it is, he's always been like the perpetual, I don't want to say joke candidate, but like the, and this is why I said, I cannot imagine that the Democratic Party is actually going to go with him. That was why I maintained it the entire time, because he's never been any kind of serious candidate until somehow magically he has become that this year.
You're a Star Trek fan.
Yes.
I liken Joe Biden to the red shirt.
Okay.
He is the candidate who goes out on stage and dies to show that the election is serious. To make it so the other candidates can have a better experience and have more drama in their process. And this time, somehow, the last guy on the planet is still wearing the red shirt.
Well, it's funny because they do, from the original, in the original series, the red shirt was security. And when they shifted to the Next Generation and their, and forward, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, red actually indicated command. So it was an interesting little juxtaposition. I don't know if that was intentional, that they intended to kind of have this little inside joke that, hey, look, the red shirts are now in command. But it looks like, once again, reality is following Star Trek.
Yeah.
Not only like the cell phones with the flip phones and the Star Trek communicators and being able to talk to our computers, but now we have red shirts running, I guess, potentially running the country. I was going to go somewhere with that.
If only Joe Biden were Jean-Luc Picard.
There are so many ways that he is not Jean-Luc. He's like the anti-Jean-Luc Picard.
He really is.
And like, Jean-Luc Picard is like thoughtful and articulate and calm and, yeah, bald. I guess to go to your point about how it's incredible that in this, I'm a year or two removed from Me Too, hashtag Me Too, and Believe All Women, and in the throes of like this countrywide look at criminal justice reform and the police and systemic racism and Black Lives Matter, it's hard to imagine a worse candidate than Joe Biden.
Has he been on the right side of anything? That's one of the reasons I think that he's pivoting so hard on healthcare right now, because he is next to Obama when Obamacare comes through. He famously says, this is a big fucking deal on the hot mic, right? And it was a big deal, but it wasn't something that he did. It was something that he and his party had dreamed of for generations, perhaps, but it wasn't really his efforts that made it happen. But he's able to talk about it, and it's a positive thing. You know, one of his, perhaps, legacies that is less tainted than all of these other ones.
Being President Obama's vice president?
Well, he's definitely leaning hard on that, but not just President Obama's vice president, but the accomplishments of Obama, in especially regarding healthcare, coverage for pre-existing conditions. And he's able to talk about the healthcare moment right now of coronavirus and the likelihood that there are lingering effects due to coronavirus that are affecting a number of people, and how that will be counted as a pre-existing condition in some cases, and our healthcare plan protects these people, and he's trying to shut that down. He's responsible for, and he being Trump here, is responsible for making it as bad as it was and not making it better, and you can't let this guy continue. So that is a line of attack that is obviously much more successful, because it points to actual successes that he has had as a politician, rather than trying to lean on his record anywhere else where it isn't successful, where it was successful, he got things done, but we now look back on it with the eyes of history and say, ooh, yeah, that was a bad choice.
Yeah, maybe the crime bill had some bad unintended consequences that we're dealing with right now. So, and what other topics? The first question, and I guess this is somewhat related to what we've been talking about, was about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat. Vacated after her death, and how Trump has nominated Amy Coney Barrett.
Yep.
Yeah. As a potential replacement, and as we've touched on, the obvious hypocrisy in terms of the comparison between Merrick Garland and how he was nominated by President Obama in much the same circumstance within a year.
Not even close, election. Honestly. It was so far. He was nominated in like January. It was a long. No, it must have been February, but it was very early in the year. Mm-hmm. But it was in the election year, and you know the prospect of losing Antonin Scalia's seat. You know, the lion of the court, this conservative master of jurisprudence and originalism, the fact that Obama would replace him with someone like an Elena Kagan or a Justice Sotomayor with Merrick Garland, it really rankled conservatives. And, you know, has happened in the past. Other justices have been replaced by justices who are very, very differently minded. You know, Clarence Thomas replaced Thurgood Marshall. That was a big change. So it's not the first time that it would have happened, but it was extremely upsetting for conservatives. And I think this is something that people that are on the left of this situation don't really appreciate as much, considering how important the Supreme Court has become to conservative movements over the past 30 years. The idea of losing Scalia's seat, with Kennedy still on the court being unreliable and Roberts being unreliable, it was looking grim. And so they pulled out all the stops to try and prevent it. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with the idea of preventing that nomination. Politically, they were in power. They had the ability to do so. I think the mechanism that Mitch McConnell chose to do that was damaging. They didn't have to set this up so that the precedent was, we're not even going to have the hearing. They could have said, okay, we will sit Merrick Garland for this. We'll interview him. We'll test him out. And we'll vote. He had the votes. They could vote no on every single Obama candidate they wanted until Obama happened to nominate somebody that they actually liked, which was never going to happen. And then it's all fine. But they didn't even give him a hearing. And that is, I think, the biggest issue. If they had just said no, it wouldn't be as damaging right now. They could have said no, and they could have used even the same. We don't think that this is the right time. We want to wait until the elections. And if Obama wins Clinton wins the election, then fine. She can nominate hers and she'll win because we're done at that point. But they didn't do that. And they set that precedent, and now they're being hypocritical, and they are really in a box. And for political motives, you know, Lindsey Graham is backing off on that, doing all his things and saying, you know, use my words against me. Well, he's in a tight Senate race himself and decided that apparently he needs to appeal to his conservative base by voting for Barrett. I actually don't know if that's going to work for him. I think that this might actually hurt him more than it helps him, but it's really tough to say that this is at all how this should be playing out. But like I said, it's just the continuation. It's the last. And I can't even say it's the last, because we could have the court packing next year. This could continue on. It's, you know, I was talking about it as an avalanche in the analogy before, but it's just this continuing escalation. It will continue to blow up. You know, how many members of the Supreme Court can you have? Well, the Constitution doesn't say. That means, well, we have 9, but we can get to 11. And if we get to 11, the next time it will be 13, and then 15. And pretty soon you have a Supreme Court that's the size of Congress. Why not? Yeah. There's no reason why they can't.
I saw a tweet that was like, it's the year 2030 and there are like 5,000 members on the Supreme Court. Something really preposterous like that. I'm a parent. I have 2 kids. And one thing that I try to impart on my kids, 2 things that are seemingly obvious as an adult, but as a kid, it's kind of world-changing, is A, 2 wrongs don't make a right. And B, I don't really care who started it. The argument that they started it doesn't really matter.
No, and those are point, pretty close. Going on.
Yeah, and those are pretty closely entwined. Like you know, I whenever I see my 2 kids fighting, and sure, I know one of them started it, but I also know that they were both in the wrong, right? Because they both escalated it, and all they care about in the world is trying to point out which one of them started it, which one was the most in the wrong. And I tried to impress upon them, I don't really care. Both you did wrong stuff. I don't care who started it. The other one didn't have to respond. And it seems like this is something that's completely lost on the 2 major parties. Like, sure, each party can point to, oh, the Democrats started by Harry Reid getting rid of the filibuster, and by how they tried to assassinate the character of Kavanaugh. And the Democrats can point out, oh, look at the naked hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell and what he did before, except completely ignoring the fact that the Democrats have completely switched sides on what they believe as well. And there is a decent point that the Republicans have held the Senate both times. The situations aren't completely identical. Like, to your point, they could have voted no on Merrick Garland, and it wouldn't have been quite the upset of precedent. So it's distressing to me that our political leaders seem to be more focused on pointing out who started it and trying to find some sort of escalated wrong to fix the previous wrong to somehow make it right. And that's all they care about right now. We're going from a mistake made, or however you want to call it, mistake, miscalculation, upset of precedent, something with Merrick Garland, to a continuation of that now with Amy Coney Barrett, and then potentially court packing, and who knows what else is coming down the line next. It's distressing to me, and I don't like it.
No, it is absolutely distressing. And I mean, I called out going all the way back to Bork, you know, in the 1980s. But that, again, doesn't mean that that's where it started. Just because I can say, well, look back to that thing all that way back, they started it. No, I mean, you could probably point back to something 10, 15 years before that that the Republicans did wrong and that started the Democrats down this line. It's not just this one thing. It's always a cascading effect. So you're absolutely right that this back and forth bickering is very childlike between the two parties. And why is that? Well, we could say maybe it's a coarsening of American discourse. We don't have the intellectual giants we used to have. I think it probably comes back down to the idea that the two parties haven't really changed a ton. There's been some fluctuation in overall ideology over the past few decades, but you still have Republicans, you still have Democrats. We haven't had a true party realignment for a very long time, and they've just become very accustomed to being in power, and there's no natural predators in the wild. So they don't have to grow up. They don't have to, you know, do anything other than this, because, well, if we lose this election, that's fine. We'll come back and we'll win the next one, because we'll still be the other party, and we'll still have the majority of the opposition as the opposition party. We still have that aspect of power. When we don't have successful libertarians, you know, a Ross Perot would be eating this election up right now. And the crazy thing is, we do have crazy billionaires running in this election, trying to win the nomination. They're just not being talked about because they're not buying up the huge amounts of airtime that Ross Perot did.
So that's really interesting, because my first thought was to completely nod in agreement. Like, yeah, my God, why don't we have a Ross Perot in this election? And then I think back to like when Howard Schultz decided to explore possibly entering the...
Well, he got attacked viciously, didn't he?
Yeah. And I think there's something different now. And I know it's always dangerous to say like this time it's different and stuff like that, but I do feel like the circumstance, I think before with Perot, the circumstances of having a Republican president who conservatives were somewhat disappointed in. I think it's fair to say that he probably drew more from independents and people who didn't vote than anything else. But between Democrats and Republicans, I think he probably drew more from Republicans than Democrats. Is that safe to say?
That would be my assessment as well, but I don't have any backing for that. So it's just, you know, a gut feeling.
Okay. Well, that's where I'm going to go with this. I think there's something different with that than this current situation where there is such hatred by the left for Trump that any possible candidate who could be possibly viewed as taking any votes away from the opposition candidate just has
even
no chance.
One vote is just, you know, it's for, yeah. I understand. And that's fine. But you know, when those people are concerned about this, the thing to perhaps assuage them is that, look, when Ross Perot was a successful candidate, the Democrats won. I mean, yes, because you're saying he stole more votes from the Republicans than the Democrats, fine. But Bill Clinton beat the incumbent George W. Bush. Right, mm-hmm. That's a, you know, in a fairly similar situation, relatively unpopular incumbent Republican, third party challenger comes in, the Democrats won. why would that not be something that's like, okay, we can deal with this. We have just as much chance of winning as ever. Because again, we know fully well that the people who voted for Ross Perot, for the most part, were people who were not voting otherwise. The turnout was much, much up. Was up significantly. Was up significantly from where it would have been if Ross Perot was not running. Why that still matters, though, is that Clinton was a winner, but he won with a plurality rather than a majority. And something that I have really come to recognize over the past year is just how much Democrats really mean democracy. They want to have the majority rule for most things because they think they're in the majority. They think that there's a blue wave out there. The demographics are always on our side. The immigration process and all these things indicate that there's a young liberal base that's always ready to support us, and there's just many more of them than those rich old white guys who vote Republican. They truly believe that if there was direct democracy, they would win all of the time. Now, we of course don't have a direct democracy, and I think they're wrong, but a candidate in a general election who doesn't win a majority of the votes feels bad for a Democrat in a way that it doesn't feel bad for Republicans. Republicans are like, well, that's just the system. He won the majority of the Electoral College votes. We're a constitutional republic, Republicans. We're okay with this. Democrats probably looked at Bill Clinton's victory and said, that was a defeat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why it doesn't have a chance of working this time, because the way I see it is, to your point, Democrats think they've got the stranglehold on the reasonable people, the non-racist, the normal people out there. They're all going to vote Democratic. And so anytime you have any kind of candidate who's not a David Duke, who's not a Ku Klux Klan member, who's not a neo-Nazi, they're going to pull from their guy that – I mean, you look at all the hatred that was thrown at Jill Stein for being potentially – supposedly being the spoiler from 2016. It's the same idea. Like, who cares if Mark Cuban decides to run for president and he might pull – he might seem more to the right than anything else. They're still going to be like, no, he's a reasonable guy who's not a racist. He's going to pull from our Democratic majority, not those, to your point, the old rich white people who I'm going to throw in probably racist is what they probably think too. Sure, so sure. I think that's why what the problem is right now, in that there's a sense that they have the stranglehold, or they have ownership of all the votes of the good, honest, decent, non-racist people.
I'm going to use a word here that's been thrown around a lot recently. The Democrats have a privilege. They feel privileged to these votes. They feel entitled to these votes. When their candidates have not done the legwork, and they don't have the receipts for those votes.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely something to be said for that. And I kind of hate that idea. Like, obviously, you've seen some of the behind-the-scenes stuff in terms of some of the clashes I've had with some friends and acquaintances and other people about how, you know what, it's okay not to vote for Joe Biden here. And no, not voting for Joe Biden is not a vote for Trump. And no, not voting for Joe Biden doesn't mean that I hate all minorities and hope they all die. It actually doesn't mean that at all. And that kind of thinking that the Democrats have ownership, that they should have this – I won't use the word privilege because I feel like you're trying to trigger some people, and I'm not going to go down that road. I'll let you do that. But I do think that they feel like, yeah, that – I mean, you see it like if you're black and you don't know whether to vote for me or Trump, then you ain't black, or whatever the quote was. And there's a sense that if you're a minority and you're voting for Trump, then there's something wrong with you, and you're not like a true minority or something like that. You see that argument all the time.
It's a new super racist to me, but it's fallacy. It's you know, it's nothing new. It's just it's been laid out in this diorama of humanity in the Americas. And it's extremely disappointing from people who really ought to know better, who seem to claim to know better at the very least, that they continue to fall into these traps. So it's, yeah. But let's get back to the debate for a moment, because that's where we're coming to this. These are some bigger, broader,
a bit off topic.
Bigger, broader political ideas. Ultimately, I think the takeaway is, like I said, that Biden did succeed because he had less of a fall. And yet, at the same time, like I said, I am not willing to concede that Trump lost it. As much as his performance was appalling and not at all a good performance, it succeeded on a lot of the fronts that he probably felt he needed to succeed. To your point about him thinking he had to win with this two-minute exchange, which was the crux of the entire debate, he probably felt he had to win on most of these things, like we were talking about. He was staring down Biden, and Biden wasn't responding. He was constantly talking, so therefore he was winning. If you're talking, you're winning. And he got his message out to people who were going to listen to him. What didn't come up that surprised me was the teachers' unions and schools. I figured we'd have a lot more of that, because I felt that that was something that Trump could win on, that would have been easy for him to talk about, and it just didn't really come up at all.
Yeah. They talked about reopening, and Trump had a couple of, I think I tweeted out, he had a couple of confused moments where he was like, Biden wouldn't have shut down at all, and if it were up to him, we'd still be shut down. And I'm like, wait, what? That doesn't really make any sense. But yeah, it's really been interesting for me, and I'm going to try not to keep this too far away from the debate, but just to see how politicized reopening the schools has become. And I feel like it's because of teachers' unions, and because... And Trump, obviously Trump looms large over almost any kind of discussion in American politics. He's certainly played a role, but I think the involvement of teachers' unions in trying to keep schools closed, which I don't necessarily fault them for. That the purpose of unions is to look out for their workers. They're doing their job. I don't think it's the right thing for the country. But I think it's the right thing for the organization and whatnot, and you're seeing a lot of people between police unions and teachers unions. You're seeing a lot of people in this current moment who are getting their eyes open to how those organizations can sometimes not have the best interests of everybody at heart, and can sometimes prioritize the interests of their members over the greater good. I think we're certainly seeing that with police unions and how they've protected some bad cops in the past, and it's led to some of these pretty egregious instances of police misconduct, maybe not directly, but at least indirectly. And it's something that I've been aware of for a while, but I think other people are starting to be aware of, like, why, when we know so much about how students are so much less susceptible to COVID and so much less likely to spread it, and we're opening things up like restaurants and movie theaters and even some sporting events, why can't we do something that's even more important and send our kids to school? I think people are starting to realize the power that teachers unions have, and yeah, to your point, I think that could have been a big win for Trump, and I don't think he's smart enough to have realized that and to have brought it up spontaneously. But
the question about Trump's smarts has always been something that's been fascinating to me. Is Trump an idiot or is he a genius? Because
you can count me firmly in the idiot camp.
Right. FYI. He does a ton of idiotic stuff, and yet he consistently finds himself in winning positions politically because he has a finger on the pulse and chooses to make the right decisions. So is that something that he's lost in the past 4 years, where he doesn't have his finger on the pulse anymore? Or is it something that he never had and he just got astoundingly lucky and hit the right notes all at the right time in the 2016 election? I think those are impossible things to know. But I think that his failure to identify the Supreme Court as the thing that is a motivating factor for people to vote for him as here's your reward once you do vote for me, rather than his crowning triumph as people say, goodbye, Trump, thanks for the Supreme Court justices, and his inability to articulate and convince people that he is the guy who is going to make the unions bow to his will to make sure that the schools reopen and that things go back to normal, that we make America great like it was before coronavirus, because he's been pushing on this all along. And yes, maybe my response wasn't perfect, but I did the best anyone could. And it's time we stop treating this like an emergency, because emergencies don't last for 6 months. It's a new normal. We deal with the new normal. On unions, especially public sector unions, because you also brought up police unions, I just want to think back to a moment historically, two moments in particular, honestly. The first is the Air Traffic Controllers Union, which Ronald Reagan busted. So that was a public sector union, and Reagan's bust of that union was a signature political move. And I think it's fair to say that Trump thinks a lot of himself as a new Reagan, even though he's not anyone like, and not anywhere near like Reagan, but he wants to behave like Reagan. So busting a union seems like something he might want to try doing. Meanwhile, you have, you know, the liberal stalwart, FDR. And he was so pro-union, of course, except for public service unions. He said, no, pro-union everywhere. Everybody should be in a union, except government employees. Because government employees, when they unionize, their boss, the people that they're negotiating against, it's basically the taxpayers. And, you know, they need to have protections. That's fair. But at the end of the day, when they're unionized against their fellow citizens in that particular way, it's unhealthy for both that work environment and the country.
Yeah, so it's really interesting to think about. I haven't been able to stop thinking about your point about his about Trump's political instincts, and has he been successful politically, is I guess the way I would phrase it, because he became president of the United States. It's something that, like, what percentage of people who want to become president actually get to become president, and he managed to pull it off. Clearly he's been successful, but that's ignoring the previous aborted attempts that, and who knows how serious he was. But that wasn't his first attempt running for president. And he's also, by so many measures, one of the least popular presidents. And one of his favorability ratings as an incumbent going into a re-election campaign are some of the lowest that people have ever seen. And so it's hard to say that he has good political instincts or has been successful as a politician. And at the same time, it's hard to argue. He mowed through a field of very qualified, very promising Republican candidates in the primary and destroyed them. So the truth is somewhere in the middle, I guess, but it's really hard to judge.
I think one of the things that's hard for people to understand about Trump, because he is so divisive on a personal level, his style, his tone, his language, his mechanisms by which he communicates are so unpleasant to so many people that it's very hard for people to see past that and see the things he's actually doing. And yes, he talks about, well, I'm going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it, and it's this great thing that he promised and didn't happen, right? So his campaign promises, his pie-in-the-sky stuff that was never going to happen. Politicians say this kind of stuff all the time. So would he have had more success if he had been more successful in his immigration reform processes? Probably. I think that's something that he probably regrets not being able to get through. But the things he has done politically, he has made significant changes to the way the federal government operates. He has changed the tenor of how things operate at the high levels and at the low levels. He's really shaken things up. You know, after 8 years of Obama, they had a general understanding of how they were going to do things, and he came in and completely upended things. He didn't drain the swamp, but he certainly changed the waters out. You know, he made it a different swamp. And I think one thing that is very important, and a lot of people do understand this and talk about it, but it is really, really critical to understand them from a political perspective, is that his political instincts are very on about the courts in general. He understands the importance of the courts, at least as a political motivator, and has worked very hard to fill so many of those federal court seats that were open. Open because the Senate wouldn't confirm Obama's nominations because the Republicans were in the majority, not just for Merrick Garland, but for the federal district judges as well, and has put already two Supreme Court justices on, and is now nominating a third. So when you have the instincts that political power means much more than the political theater, he's been unable to get a lot of things done while people are paying all this attention to, oh my God, what an awful person he is.
And he did make it did seem to be a concentrated effort by him to point out about the judges during the debate. I think I'm not sure he brought it up on his own or if it was related to another question, but he even brought it up like, oh, yeah, under the Obama administration, you left me so many openings and that, you know, I wanted to thank you for that because I was able to fill them all or whatever. And it wasn't an entirely coherent way that he said it, but basically he was trying to point out like, yeah, look, I nominated a bunch of judges, hooray me. So I think you're spot on about that. Were there any other topics that you thought were discussed that were interesting? Because I have one more that I thought was a potential win for Trump, but I'm curious if you have any others.
No, I think we've covered the big ones. So what do you have? Let's see what the last point is.
So this could be my own personal bias just because I've been listening to some podcasts that have been discussing this recently, but I think the discussion about the unrest in Portland and maybe even a broader sense of the mostly peaceful protests that have been going on throughout the country and the sense of how Biden might be not sufficiently tough on them. And the way that he tried to connect Biden to a potential tolerance of this unrest. I don't know if it's a fair thing to tar Biden with. I think Biden has been, to his credit, pretty consistent in condemning the violence that has been going on with these riots. So I want to stress and do the throat clearing that, you know, this isn't necessarily a fair comparison, but I think it is something that could land home with a lot of people. I think a lot of people who might find Trump distasteful and a terrible human being and even disagree with a lot of his politics might be looking at the news every night about the...
Just to clarify, you said looking at the news every night?
Yes.
I heard you say...
Nudes?
Yeah, I heard you say nudes. They're looking at the nudes every night.
Or they're looking at their nudes every night, you know, and thinking, man, I really need more diversity in my pornography. Or I don't know.
Or I need to do more crushes because I'm getting a little paunch now. Look at their own nudes.
No, the NEWS every night. And seeing, like, you know, for a while, the front page was like burning federal building or, you know, unrest and everything, and people that worries people. People get scared about that, and they rightfully or wrongfully will probably look towards the candidate that they think will keep them safe. And I think Trump was effective at portraying himself as the guy who will do that, and Biden as the guy who might be like, oh, I'll just let, you know, Portland burn and, you know, I'm going to support all these protesters, even though, again, I don't think that's a fair accusation. But I think he did a good job of making a contrast there.
I think that's a fair point. I would say that there are voters who are interested in a paternalistic government, the government that is there to protect them rather than to permit them to do things. And those voters tend to be more conservative, so they were going to lean towards Trump anyway, under most circumstances, but maybe they were turned off by him. But maybe he was able to re-energize some of those conservatives or conservative-leaning voters to say, okay, yeah, he's right. I'll vote for him, even though he is distasteful, because 4 more years of him is law and order, one of the things he is being credited as having done well and talked about well, even if it isn't necessarily true. You know, perception becomes the reality rather than what we understand reality to be, whereas Biden is maybe a little soft on it, even though he's also the guy that had the major crime bill that went through and really – so, you know, Biden is not the weak candidate on law and order that he could have been, and yet it's still a win for Trump because the nature of the people interested in that is leaning conservative. So that was definitely something that I've seen in the analysis and felt as well. Whether that works out in Trump's favor overall is going to depend a lot on the events that play out over the next few weeks, I think. Until the election, although there's already been about a million people who have voted, apparently. There's a million votes in already, so that's a lot of votes already. And those votes are going to be counted regardless of these events that come forward. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. But if there is massive unrest and violent protests happening in several cities, then Trump's depiction of himself as law and order becomes threatened, and how he responds to it is important. Because if he cannot control that, then it looks really bad for him. And if he does control it, but he controls it in a way that is heavy-handed and violent, then there's also going to be a backlash against him. So it's a real difficult position for him to be in, because the violence is occurring right now in his country. And yeah, we understand he's the president. He doesn't control this. He has no authority over any of these situations. But if people are looking at that top-down solution and saying, okay, you're the guy who are asking to have law and order, he's also the incumbent. So if there is that lack of law and order, I think that could end up hurting him as well. If things are generally peaceful, if we have a tick down in coronavirus and violence goes away, then yeah, that law and order and make America great and things are doing okay and the economy's back open and football's back on, that message plays better for him than it would otherwise.
Oh, you were going to say something?
I have a little bit more.
Go.
The question comes down to this lack of civility that's going on in our country, the militias and the violence, and very understandable people upset about racial injustice and violence against minority communities by the police officers, and historic injustices that are finally coming forward, both in Me Too and those other elements. It's all an amalgam of awfulness in 2020, and that's just the human side of things. We haven't talked about climate change and how all those things are playing into natural disasters. Again, something that might play well to Biden, but Biden is not particularly strong on the climate change thing either. But on the human scale of things, a lot of energy has been put forward talking about how Trump is bad for the discourse, the quality of our general conversation in America, because his personal conversation and way of talking is so bad, so dismissive, so offensive. And I'm going to bring it back and harp on my favorite subject. Is it Trump doing this, or is Trump really a symptom of it? And if Trump is the symptom of it, which is what I believe, is it not more something like the problem that we know that Facebook is causing, with its natural divisiveness heightening some of these issues, that can allow someone like Trump to come out, who allow this QAnon conspiracy and effectively a cult to spring up? And those people could be a major impact on the election as well, as someone who is prone to believe QAnon is much more likely to vote for Trump than they are to vote for Biden. And that is something that has been growing significantly, and it's under the radar enough, even though it's been discussed a lot over the past few months, that how that moves the election is something that could happen without even being seen, perhaps either in the polls, and certainly not by journalists, even though it's something they're more aware of now. So as we see this play out, we don't know what the future is going to hold. We don't know how this election is going to go. You know, Biden is looking like he is the leader, but even with him on paper being leader and having a performance in this debate where he succeeded as much as he could possibly hope to, I think, I don't think this election's in the bag yet. Earlier on, during the Democratic debates, I was very skeptical of any of these Democrats' chance at beating Trump. And I've mentioned since then that, while circumstances have changed, the situation with coronavirus and the unrest in this country has made Donald Trump a weaker incumbent than he would have been otherwise. But as much as he has weakened, with Biden also being a weak candidate, and with things potentially getting better, with events still to unfold, I do not at all feel comfortable saying, oh yeah, Biden has this in his shoe, you know, he's going to win in a landslide. This is probably going to be a pretty close election. And I don't think this debate changes the outcome much, which means that it gives Trump that extra visibility to make his case to his base and say, come on out and vote for me. And maybe that means it helps him more than helped Biden.
I mean, we really haven't had a not close election in our lifetime, right?
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, in our lifetime, absolutely. Mondale was destroyed.
Okay, in our like lifetime that we were aware of what was going on.
I was paying attention.
I'm sure you were.
I was.
Because you're like 60 years old.
Yes, right. Well, I'll tell you a story later on, but we've been going along. If I don't want to roll that anecdote right now.
All right. Well, I'll just, I'll say this. If Trump's chances of winning are based on Facebook cooperating by spreading QAnon conspiracies, then I think he's boned. Because Facebook has been doing everything in their power, as far as I can tell, to try and convince people to vote. And
convincing people to vote doesn't help Biden. You're falling into a Democratic trap of saying they are entitled to these voters who are rational and they're just going to all vote for Biden because everyone hates Trump. No, a lot of people like Trump. A lot of people like Trump. They just don't talk about it.
A lot of people like Trump and they don't talk about it, but I do think they vote. And I think a lot of the people a lot of people who hate Trump won't necessarily vote unless they're pestered incessantly by Facebook. And I will say Facebook and its sister property, Instagram, I think 8, 9, 10 times I've seen Facebook itself be like, hey, did you know it's National Voting Day? Oh, hey, here's how you request a ballot. Oh, hey, do you need to know like how to register? Like, no, shut up. I've literally posted a picture of my mail-in ballot that I've received on Facebook. Please stop telling me how to register to vote. I know how to vote. I've been doing it for how many elections now? So that's my response to that. Secondly, is Trump the cause or the symptom? I think he's a symptom, but not of Facebook or whatever your conspiracy theory is.
My conspiracy theory. Okay.
Yes. That was intentional. Do you want to defend yourself or should I just keep going? Like Trump?
Let's see where you're going. Okay, how deep you dig yourself.
I think he's a backlash to, it's tough using this term, but like the political correctness or the cancel culture, what I have seen in my experience as the increasing intolerance from the left of certain viewpoints and the increasing willingness to go from, oh, you disagree on me with this, then you're clearly racist, sexist, transphobic, or whatever like the bigoted, whatever the super extreme is on it, and to basically place certain viewpoints as with outside of the Overton window. They're viewpoints that cannot be expressed in polite company or any company, and they are just completely not allowed to be said. And so you do that for long enough, and then you get a candidate out there who's basically a walking, talking, just smashing norms all over the place.
Is there any part like, of Trump that has ever been in the Overton window?
Exactly. He lives completely outside the Overton window. He is just like the epitome of anti-politically correct. Yes, I think I got that right. He's not politically correct, and it's a super oversimplification, but I do think it's like the whole to own the libs and to taste the liberal tears or whatever your meme of choice or saying of choice is. I think there is a lot to that. The whole idea that like we're tired of getting beaten up by like all these accusations of racism and saying that our viewpoints are completely intolerable. Like how do you like it when we just like we put up this guy? How do you like this? So that's my response to that.
The absolute assassination of the character of Romney in the 2012 election.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh my God, if Romney gets elected, he's going to be the devil and it's going to be the worst thing ever for this country. I do think there was an awful lot of, oh, you thought Romney was bad? Well, you're all praising him now as this model of Republican decorum because look at who we gave you instead.
Yeah, I mean, they were calling Romney racist back then.
Probably still are, honestly. But, he's not as bad as Trump, so therefore he's now more acceptable. And it's like, well, you know what? He hasn't really changed all that much in 4 years.
And didn't Trump get like more Latino votes than Romney did?
Yes, he did.
Despite all the, they're all rapists and some, I can't remember what his saying was, but.
Yes, no, he got more Hispanic votes. He got more African-American votes than Romney did. So, yeah, absolutely. That is a huge thumbing of the nose at the establishment, if nothing else. I will not give up on the Facebook thing, because everything you're saying about, oh, get out the vote, Facebook, they did it in 2016 too. I was on Facebook in 2016 still, so I remember it, and I am not on Facebook now, which means I'm not having it clouded by, you know, things that are currently occurring. They were very heavily engaged in, make sure you vote, here's how you vote, have you registered to vote. The notification was on my wall every day, right? And maybe they've made it more cumbersome and pestering so that people will respond to it, but it was pretty bad to start with. And I will say also that they're doing a really bad job of it right now in 2020, because even though I am not on Facebook, I am seeing people who are on Facebook and hearing from them that, you know, my friend in Florida has received a notification that she should apply for an absentee ballot in two different states, neither of which is Florida. Right? So that's a huge problem, especially where you are in a situation where Trump is, again, calling the credibility and legitimacy of this election, since so much of it will be done by mail, into question. To have an organization as big and as powerful as Facebook pummeling people and saying, make sure you register to vote in this other state, that looks really bad. Even if it doesn't result in a single instance of voter fraud, which it won't, because that's not how voter fraud happens, it just looks bad. And exactly what I said before, the perception of voter fraud becomes the reality of people's expectations.
All right. Well, I think we should leave that to our listeners. So if you think that what Facebook is led directly to the election of Trump, then let us know in the comments. If you think that I'm right and that this is a crazy conspiracy theory by Andrew, then let us know in the comments. We're running a little short on time. So what, you want to do some lightning round questions?
Come at me, bro.
Okay. So do you think the debates made a difference in terms of the support of the candidates, the outcome of the election, anything?
Like I said at the beginning, the 5% that were perhaps inquiring probably didn't get enough information. I don't think it changed them. Each of the candidates had enough wins that the people who were already supporting them are going to feel okay about it, but a lot of people are going to be turned off. So I don't think it made a difference, except that maybe it suppresses voter turnout even more.
Do you think we'll see another debate between Biden and Trump?
Yes.
Do you think that there'll be a mute button?
No.
I guess you probably already answered that. Do you, so, and you're on record, you think the election will be close?
I do think this election will be close, which is probably bad for us. I think that a close election causes a lot of strife, maybe some actual unrest. Maybe people die as a result of this close election. That'd be awful. It's not what I want. But a close election is also usually a sign of a healthy democracy. I mean, people weren't saying that it was a healthy democracy when Saddam Hussein was winning 98% of the vote, right? So a contested election is important, but I think in this case, a closely contested election will result in bad outcomes.
Do you think turnout will be higher this election than it was in the last election, 2016?
Tough, tough question. How are you counting voter turnout?
Percentage of eligible voters who voted.
When they vote, are we saying that their vote counted and was in the count of votes that each state has, or that the vote was attempted?
Good question. I will say try to vote.
Try to vote will be much, much higher.
Okay. That's fair. Do you think that any third-party candidate will break 2%?
No.
1%?
Probably not. That one's tougher. You know, Jorgensen, I don't think she breaks 1%, but she's the only one that can.
Will any candidate get 50% of the popular vote?
Since the third parties are taking such a small percentage, it seems that the winner would probably get 50%, but it's going to be really, really close. I think this is quite literally like a 50.1 to a 40.8 kind of election kind of going down. And, you know, that means that the Libertarians got to a 0.1%. I think they get more than a 0.1%, but, you know, that's the kind of margin that we might be looking at here, where in popular votes, in electoral votes, you know, electoral vote, this could actually be more of a landslide than it is in the popular vote, where just because how things line up, the Electoral College could be very, very clear, but the popular vote is not. And thank goodness in that case, because the popular vote doesn't matter in the least.
So does that brings me to my next question. Does the winner of the popular vote win the electoral vote?
Probably not. I think.
Interesting. So it sounds like you're predicting a Trump win.
It's so tough because I do think Biden has all the things he needs to have an edge in this environment. And I do think, if you ask me, do I think Biden's going to win? I'm going to say, yeah, probably. I think Biden's the favorite. I'd say Biden wins 55-60% of the time, which is pretty high. But it's certainly not as high as the 538, for example, is calling it. And it's higher than a lot of people think. Biden is going to win either by a landslide or by a sizable number. I think it's going to be a lot closer than that. If Biden wins, he wins the majority of the popular vote and the Electoral College. Obviously, at that point, he's won the Electoral College. And then the majority in the Electoral College is going to be probably bigger than his popular vote. If Trump wins, his Electoral College victory percentage will be significantly higher than his popular vote percentage.
For the record, I think much bigger turnout, voter turnout, by the method that I described counting it. I think Biden wins, but I do think Trump does better than people are expecting.
Yeah.
So somewhat along the lines of you. Do you think we'll know the outcome of the election on Election Day?
Not a chance.
How long until we find out? And does it go to the Supreme Court?
So the question comes down to which states are close enough in their counts and how many of them are close in their count that certification is an issue. And if there are enough of them that it can hold up the count, like Florida. Florida is a big state and it was holding up the entirety of the Electoral College because its certification process in 2000 was underway. If you have a situation like that or several states that combine to a Florida size or several states that all Florida size or bigger all have these kinds of close elections, which can certainly happen, you could easily not know the likely winner until late November, even into December. At some point, the states will be forced to certify. The precedent has been set with Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court, especially now that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has passed. Even if Barrett doesn't end up on the Supreme Court before this point, the majority of the a liberal member died. So it's 5-3 in a sense on the court right now, which means it would have to go to extraordinary lengths not to maintain that Bush v. Gore precedent. Like something really weird would have to be going on, which means that certifications of the elections will be forced on a time schedule that matches each state's constitutional expectations. That being said, those differ, and which state has the problems will decide so much of this. Like, if Texas has a problem, no one cares. If Texas is having a problem figuring out who won Texas, the election is not in question. It's going to be those battleground states. If Minnesota is close, if Pennsylvania is close, if Ohio is close, if all three of those are close, it is going to be an absolute nightmare. And Black Friday will not just be a shopping holiday. It will be chaos for all Americans.
So, yeah, I was going to say, looking forward to some fun family dinners and Thanksgiving then. I guess that's a good transition. Black Friday, like, will we see, hate to ask you, but will we see unrest and violence in the wake of an unknown election outcome or in the wake of a disagreeable election outcome, whatever it is? And will there be an issue with one side or the other conceding?
It is my supreme wish that there is no violence. It is my expectation that there will be some level of violence. So that's a bad place to be in. I don't think that this election, democracy and politics are the resolution of disputes by means other than war. And the problem that we're having right now in America is that too many people don't feel that they have trust in the institutions to have an outcome that is fair and just. And so therefore, the mechanisms for resolving this non-violently are being taken away from them. And all it takes is a handful of people to say, my understanding and my feelings are not being respected in this. I don't feel that this is fair. I'm going to take matters into my own hand to make sure that the outcome that I need to have or I want to have is at least appreciated more than it is right now. And a couple of lone actors or a couple of militia groups or one group of crazy people in one state could have a very bad outcome. I don't expect it to last long at the violent stage, but I do think we could have significant political unrest for a period of time throughout all of November, depending on how close those elections are and how long that certification process lasts. If it all comes together pretty quick and certifies pretty quick, the outbreak of violence that I'm still expecting, unless there's a unexpected outcome in the election night and election week, will be extremely short-lived and probably a blip. But there is a real chance that this gets very, very ugly.
So it sounds like 2020 will be going out the same way that it came in.
This is going to be a continuation of 2020. This is a bad year for the world. It's a bad year for America. I do not see it getting better. We can only hope that 2021 is going to be better. But 2021 will start with the inauguration of the new president. You know, January 20th. It's close to the start. So if things are not resolved by then, you know, there's no guarantee 2021 is going to be better. And especially if you are seeing wildfires and hurricanes as the natural disaster elements of 2020 that are so bad, and the coronavirus is still ongoing, we are not out of the woods when it comes to continued natural disasters. So, yeah, I am hoping that this is not super depressing for people here, but I'm not super optimistic about the next 3 to 4 months.
Well, you're not exactly known as the ray of sunshine amongst the Rampant Discourse crew, so that's fine.
I'm on brand.
Yes, exactly. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you wanted to touch upon?
I think we've covered enough. I'm tired. It's been a lot of tough stuff, and I really hope that I am wrong, because the bleak future that I do envision is not what I want any more than anyone else wants. It's just something that I think is too much of a percentage chance to not be preparing for. And the more you are aware of the risk, the better you can prepare for them yourself.
All right. So it sounds like you're advocating stocking up on canned goods, gold.
No. It's not going to be that bad. Not going to be that bad. You know, I shouldn't say it's not going to be that bad. I don't think it's going to be that bad. It'd have to be even worse than I expect it to be for it to be that bad. And I, as you said, am not the ray of sunshine. So if I'm not thinking it's going to be that bad, we may not be there yet. It may take the next presidential election for us to get that bad.
Something to look forward to then. All right. Well, maybe we'll circle back around at the next debate, assuming there is one. Facebook.com/rapiddiscourse. Discord.io/. No, wait, did I do that right? I always do that wrong. It's discord.io/rampanddiscourse. Something like that. Anyway, follow us on Twitter. Check us out on our webpage, rampantdiscourse.com. And we'd love to hear from you. Hear what you have to say about Andrew's crazy Facebook conspiracy theories or anything else that we talked about. Your predictions on the election, how the debate went, what we missed, what we should have talked about more. Thank you for joining me, Andrew. Can't stop the discourse.